From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, we continue our series of favorite interviews from the decade that just ended, and feature interviews with two music icons, Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen, who co-wrote this song. Today, we continue our series of staff picks of favorite interviews from the past decade. Coming up later in the show, Bruce Springsteen. But first, Patti Smith. That's Patti Smith in the opening track of her 1975 debut studio album, Horses. Known as the godmother of punk, she created a hybrid of poetry and rock and developed a high-energy performance style that was sometimes aggressive and sometimes ecstatic. Terry Gross interviewed Patti Smith in 2010 after the publication of her memoir, Just Kids, which won a National Book Award. It's about growing up in New Jersey, moving to New York in 1967, and slowly evolving into a poet, songwriter, and performer. The book revolves around her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, whom she met just after she got to New York. They became soulmates, and both aspired to be artists. She became famous first. The album that made her famous, Horses, had an iconic photo of her taken by Mapplethorpe. He later became known for his erotic and sadomasochistic photos of gay men. He died of AIDS in 1989.
Patti Smith, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's in New York that you met Robert Mapplethorpe, and you changed the course of each other's lives. Would you tell the story of how you met Robert Mapplethorpe?
Well, my first meeting was very simple. I had some friends at Pratt Institute, people that went to my high school that had the means to go to art school. And I was looking for them, hoping for a little shelter since I had nowhere to sleep that night. But when I went to visit them, they had moved, and the boy that answered the door didn't know where my friends had moved and said, "Well, go in there and maybe my roommate will know where they are." And I went in a room and there was a boy sleeping, lying on a little iron bed, and just with a mass of dark curls. And as soon as I walked in, he awoke and looked at me and smiled. And then I talked, and he knew where my friends had lived. But the thing that I remember, the very first impression I have of Robert, is waking up and smiling.
At some point, you realized that Mapplethorpe was gay. At some point, he realized that he was gay. How did it affect his relationship with you when he came to terms with being gay and had lovers and eventually had a long-time lover? Were you able to stay as close even though the relationship had changed?
Well, Robert and I always were just as close. I mean, we had to work out, obviously, the physical aspect of our relationship. And it was really me who, in the end, severed the physical aspect of our relationship. You know, in the end, we worked that out. I mean, because we were so close and our love for each other was so deep that the absence of, and we were still physical with one another. He was always very affectionate till the day he died. We were still affectionate toward one another.
In your book, you write about how Mapplethorpe's work started to change and become more sadomasochistic in its imagery, which he became quite famous for. And you write that that imagery was bewildering and frightening to you. You write, he couldn't share things with me because it was so outside our realm, and that you couldn't comprehend the brutality of his images of self-inflicted pain. It was hard for you to match it with the boy you had met. Can you talk a little bit more about your reaction to his images and what you found disturbing and incomprehensible about it?
Well, they're disturbing images.
They're meant to be disturbing.
I'm just,
yeah. Right.
I mean, Robert, a lot of my reaction was out of, first of all, naivety. I didn't know anything about that world. I still know very little about that world. And my protective instincts for Robert, they frightened me. I worried that he would be hurt or something bad would happen to him. But he was always assured me that all of these situations were controlled, consensual situations. I mean, there were a few of these images that I thought were actually brilliant. And so we were able, after I processed the subject matter, to talk about these images as art. But I was never really curious to talk about them in any other way. And he respected that.
You say that until a friend suggested that you be in a rock and roll band, it had never occurred to you. It was just like not part of your
no,
world.
No, why would it? You know, I'm not a musician. You know, I didn't play any instrument. I didn't have any specific talents. I mean, I came from the South Jersey, Philadelphia area, and in the early 60s, everybody sang. They sang on street corners, three-part harmonies, a cappella. Most of my friends were better singers than me. There was nothing in what I did that would give a sense that I should be in a rock and roll band. Also, girls weren't in rock and roll bands. I mean, they sang, but, you know, the closest thing to a rock singer, a real rock singer that we had was Grace Slick. And I certainly didn't have Grace Slick's voice.
You were saying that you didn't have, you know, you didn't think of yourself as a singer per se, that your friends had better voices than you did. But you created this new style, really, that was a combination of poetry and music. It wasn't about having, like, a perfect singer's voice. It was the style that you performed and the personality that you put into it, the kind of defiance that you had in some songs, the energy. Would you talk about what you felt you were doing early on that was different from what you'd seen other people do?
I think my perception of myself was really as a performer and a communicator. I had a mission when we recorded Horses. My mission was...
That's your first album.
My first album, Horses. My mission and the collective band mission was really... on one level, to merge poetry and rock and roll, but more humanistically, to reach out to other disenfranchised people. In 1975, the, you know, young homosexual kids were, you know, being disowned by their families. The kids were, you know, kids like me who were a little weird or a little different were often persecuted in their small towns, and it wasn't just because of sexual persuasion. It was for any reason, for being an artist, for being different, for having political views, for just wanting to be free. And I really recorded the record to connect with these people. And also, in terms of our place in rock and roll, just to create some bridge between our great artists that we had just lost, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison among them, and to create space for what I felt would be the new guard, which I didn't really include myself. I was really anticipating people or bands like The Clash and The Ramones. I was anticipating in my mind that a new breed would come, television, a new breed would come and they would be less materialistic, more bonded with the people, and not so glamorous. I wasn't thinking so much of music. I wasn't thinking so much of perfection or stardom or any of that stuff. I was thinking, I had this mission, and I thought I would do this record and then go back to my writing and my drawing and, you know, return to my, you know, my somewhat abnormal, normal life. But but Horses took me on a whole different path.
Is there a track from Horses that particularly illustrates what you were describing as what your mission was?
Birdland.
Okay.
I think Birdland, because for various reasons, Birdland was an improvisation built on an improvisation. It so much exemplifies the communication of my band, especially between Richard, Lenny, and I. And it speaks of this new breed, you know, the new generations who will be dreaming in animation, you know, the new generations that will race across the fields, no longer presidents but prophets. That was my it was like my telegram to the new breed.
Oh, let's hear it. This is Birdland from Patti Smith's first album, Horses.
Shape of a tortured woman, the mother standing in the doorway, letting her sons no longer presidents but prophets. They're all dreaming they're gonna bear the prophet. He's gonna run through the fields, dreaming in animation. It's all gonna split his skull. It's gonna come out like a black bouquet, shining like a fist that's gonna shoot him up like Muhammad.
Robert Mapplethorpe did the very iconic photograph for the cover of Horses. Would you briefly describe the photo?
Well, it's very classic photograph by Robert, very simple. I'm standing against a white wall with a triangular shadow, and dressed in the clothes typical of myself then, and just an old white shirt, a clean old white shirt, sort of a black ribbon that symbolizes a tie or a cravat, black pants, jacket slung over my shoulder, looking directly at Robert. It's has a little bit of Baudelaire, a little bit of Catholic Boy, a little bit of Frank Sinatra, and a lot of Robert.
What impact do you think that photo had on how people perceived you?
Well, I don't know. I know people really liked it. I know the record company didn't.
They didn't? And, that's such a great photo. Why didn't the record company like it?
Because my hair was messy, because, you know, it was a little incomprehensible to them at the time. But I fought for it, and they did try to airbrush my hair, but I made sure that was fixed. People were very upset constantly about my appearance when I was young. I don't know what it was. You know, they just, it was very hard for them to factor. But I've always had that problem. Even as a child, you know, I used to go to the beach when I was a little kid and just want to wear my dungarees and my flannel shirt. And the whole time people would be, why are you wearing that? Why don't you get a bathing suit? You know, it's like, leave me alone. It's just like, I'm not bothering you. Why are you worried about, you know, what I look like? You know, it's just, I'm not trying to bother anybody. But people love the photograph. The people on the streets love the photograph. And it gave Robert some instant attention. I think it was his, you know, it really helped, you know, launch his work into the public consciousness. And so we were both very happy about that. And the funniest thing, and sort of the sweetest thing, was when I started performing after the record came out, I would go to clubs anywhere. It could be Denmark, could be in Youngstown, Ohio. And I would come on stage, and at least half of the kids had white shirts and black ties on. It was kind of cool. We all had suddenly turned Catholic.
You write that, you know, when Mapplethorpe died of AIDS in March of 89, the morning that he died, you describe your feelings, and you say that you were shuddering, overwhelmed by a sense of excitement, acceleration, as if because of the closeness that you experienced with Robert, you were to be privy to his new adventure, the miracle of his death. You say this wild sensation stayed with you for some days. Could you describe that? Did you know he was dying when you had you gotten the phone call when you felt this, or were you just feeling this, you know, without even?
No, I felt that after he died.
After he died.
I had already received the call that he had died. I mean, we knew that he was dying. We knew that he was dying the last couple of weeks of his life. I talked to him. I talked to Robert in the last hour that he could still speak. And I listened to his breathing before I went to sleep. His brother called me and let me listen to his breathing, and he died that morning. So that sensation that I felt was his, you know, acceleration into his next place after death. I could really feel that. I've experienced a lot of death since Robert. I sat with Allen Ginsberg when he died. I was with my husband when he died, my parents. But Robert, the acceleration and energy I felt after Robert's death was unique. And it did stay with me for quite a while. And I think that each of us, you know, our energy leaves in a different way according to the person, you know, according to the energy of the person, the way the spirit manifests. Each of us die differently, and we have, you know, I believe that. I believe we all have a unique journey, whether it's a journey of pure energy, if there's any intelligence within the journey. But I think each of us have our own way of dissipating or entering a new field.
You say that one of the people who you were with when he died was Allen Ginsberg. And in your memoir, you mentioned some advice that Ginsberg had given you after your husband died. He said, let go of the spirit of the departed and continue your life's celebration. Having experienced as much death as you have, is that good advice, do you think?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that time heals all wounds is not really true. Our wounds aren't really ever healed. We just learn to walk with them. We learn that some days we're going to feel intense pain all over again, and we just have to say, okay, I know you. If you can come along with me today, and the same way that sometimes we start laughing out in the middle of nowhere, remembering something that happened with someone we've lost. And, you know, life is the best thing that we have. We each have a life. We each have to negotiate it and navigate it. And I think it's very important that we enjoy our life, that we get everything we can out of it. And it doesn't take away from our love of the departed. I mean, I take Fred along with me in the things that I do, or Robert, or my father, or my mother. You know, whoever wants to come along, they can be with me. And, you know, if I want them, I can sense them. You know, we have our own life, but we can still walk with the people that we miss or that we lose. And I think it's very important to not be afraid to experience joy in the middle of sorrow, because, you know, that's what our life is. You know, it's the fearful symmetry of Blake, you know, joy and sorrow. You don't want to just feel one of them. They're both valuable to the spirit.
Patti Smith, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Nice to talk to you, too.
Poet, songwriter, and performer Patti Smith speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. Their talk was one of our staff picks for favorite interviews of the past decade. After a break, another favorite staff pick, Terry's interview with Bruce Springsteen. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Today, we're continuing our series of staff picks of favorite interviews from the past decade. This one is with Bruce Springsteen, and is special not only because of the conversation itself and the music we hear, but also because Terry visited Springsteen at his home studio in New Jersey to record it. The rare on-location interview took place in 2016 when he was publishing his memoir, which shares its title with one of his biggest hits, Born to Run. We'll start by hearing a demo recording of his song, Growing Up, from the album Chapter and Verse.
Okay, take two.
Well, I stood stone-like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade. I combed my hair till it was just right and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and crossed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. Well, I strode all along to a fallout zone and came out with my soul untouched. I hid in the cloud, it ran through the crowd. They said, sit down, I stood up. Ooh, growing up. Well, the flag of piracy flew from my mast.
Bruce Springsteen, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for welcoming us into your studio. I'd love it if you would start by reading the very opening from the foreword of your book. It's really a fantastic book, and I'd like our listeners to just hear a little bit of your writing.
Okay, my pleasure. I come from a boardwalk town where almost everything is tinged with a bit of fraud. So am I. By 20, no race car driving rebel. I was a guitar player on the streets of Asbury Park, and already a member in good standing amongst those who lie in service of the truth, artists with a small a. But I held four clean aces. I had youth, almost a decade of hardcore bar band experience, a good group of homegrown musicians who were attuned to my performance style, and a story to tell. This book is both a continuation of that story and a search into its origins. I've taken as my parameters the events in my life I believe shaped that story and my performance work. One of the questions I'm asked over and over again by fans on the street is, how do you do it? In the following pages, I'll try to shed a little light on how, and more importantly, why.
Thanks for reading that. So, what's it like for you to write something that doesn't have to rhyme and that you don't have to perform on stage?
That's actually, not having to perform it on stage is a good one. But it's a little different, you know. I'm used to writing something, it becomes a record, it comes out, then I go perform and I play it and I get this immediate feedback from the audience. So that's been the pattern of my life, but the book has been a little bit different, you know. I mean, you get feedback from the press and the fans are just starting to get a chance to read it, so I'm looking forward to that. But you still had to find the music inside your language, you know. That's a big part of what sort of moved me to begin writing the book. I wrote a little essay and I felt, yeah, this is a good voice. This is a good feeling. It feels like me. But then once you get into the book, you've got to constantly find the rhythm of your prose. It ends up being quite a musical experience either way.
Well, that's one of the things I love about the book is that there is rhythm and music in it, even though it's not a song. So many of your songs, particularly the early ones, are about, you know, like searching for a dream and wanting to like bust out of the confines of your life. And in some ways, I get the impression from your book that that was your father's story, except he never found the dream. It's kind of like a little bit like the story that you describe in your song, The River.
Right. You know, my dad was young. We went to work. But he'd been to war. He'd seen some of the world. It wasn't like he was going to be an extensive traveler or something. It didn't seem to be in the nature of his parents or many of the folks in my family. Really, we had a cousin that went off to Brown University. It was like a nuclear explosion took place. You know, it was just incredible for everybody. So you're correct. That my parents did really sort of live out a big part of that story. And to a certain degree, he did find his little piece of what he was looking for in California.
Because when you were 19, he moved to California.
Yeah, they moved out west, which was a huge undertaking because no one, it was like moving to another planet for them. But I think that's what my father wanted to do. He wanted to move to another planet. And they had very little. They had $3,000, and I think they had an old Rambler, and they slept two nights in the car and a night in a motel, and they had my little sister with them with all their stuff packed on top. It was a really go-for-broke decision, and it did pay off for them. You know, I think they enjoyed the West Coast and their California life quite a bit. You know, my father still had periods of illness that were...
Talking about mental illness?
Yeah, difficult to manage. But I believe he did feel like he found something there that he couldn't have found at home.
Do you think the song Born to Run is in part about him and in part about you?
Well, someone mentioned that to me the other day. I always thought it was just about me. But what do you know? And looking back on it, my parents lived out quite a bit of that story themselves.
Except you had a dream in a way that your father maybe didn't have a dream that he could articulate.
It certainly wasn't one he could articulate. It was just, I got to get out of here.
Yeah. So you write, too, about your father that he was kind of very, let me quote you because you put it so well. You write that he loved me, but he couldn't stand me. He felt we competed for my mother's affections. We did. He also saw in me too much of his real self. Inside, beyond his rage, he harbored a gentleness, timidity, shyness, and a dreamy insecurity. These were things I wore on the outside, and the reflection of these qualities in his boy repelled him. I was soft, and he hated soft. Of course, he'd been brought up soft, a mama's boy, just like me. So that timidity and shyness that you wore on the outside, it's kind of like the opposite of your stage persona.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's bizarre.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the timidity and shyness of your youth?
Yeah, well, T. Burnett once said that much of rock music is simply someone going, "Wow, daddy." So I've got to take some blame for that myself, I guess. But it was when I was young, you know, I was very shy and that was my personality. You know, I was a pretty sensitive kid and, quite neurotic, filled with a lot of anxiety, which all would have been very familiar to my pop, you know, except it was a part of himself he was trying to reject, so I got caught in the middle of it, I think.
So do you think that your stage persona draws both from, like, the angry and uninhibited side of you and the more inhibited, timid side of you?
I think it's both there. I think if you just, you know, I think I've had plenty of folks, if you just looked at the outside, it can read, you know, it's pretty alpha male, you know, which is a little ironic because, you know, that was personally never exactly really me. I think I created my particular stage persona out of my dad's life, and perhaps I even built it to suit him to some degree. When I was looking for a voice to mix with my voice, I put on my father's work clothes, as I say in the book, and I went to work. Whether it was a result of wanting to emulate him so I felt closer, or whether it was I wanted to be the reasonable voice of revenge for what I'd seen his life come to. It was all of these things, and it was an unusual creation. But most of these, most people's stage personas are created out of the flotsam and jetsam of their internal geography, and they're trying to create something that solves a series of very complex problems inside of them or in their history. And I think when I went to do that, that's what I was trying to integrate all of these very difficult things that I'd been unable to integrate in my life and in my life with my parents.
Bruce Springsteen speaking with Terry Gross in 2016. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR. We do long-form interviews with journalists breaking the big news stories and with the authors, filmmakers, and musicians behind the best in pop culture. So listen and subscribe.
Let's get back to Terry's 2016 interview with Bruce Springsteen.
During your early years as a musician, you were in Asbury Park, Boardwalk, Carnival Atmosphere. What did you love about that kind of urban beach?
Yeah.
And the, you know, Madame Marie and all of the, like, all the Boardwalk regulars. You made great stories out of those characters, mm-hmm. great songs out of those characters. But what appealed to you about knowing them and writing about them?
It was just my location at the time. I didn't move to Asbury with the thought of, you know, it wasn't an anthropological
but you connected in some
reason,
way.
But I went in and I just fit in there. Asbury was down on its luck, but not as bad as it would get. And so there was a lot of room to move. You know, clubs were open till 5 a.m. There were gay clubs. And even in the late 60s, it was a bit of an open city. So as young ne'er-do-wells, we fit very, you know, we fit very comfortably in that picture. And then when I went to write, I just wrote about what was around me. It fired my imagination. It was, of course, was a colorful locale. The city was filled with characters and plenty of people at loose ends. And so it just became a very natural thing to write about. I didn't give it too much thought at the time. But I did think that it gave me a very individual identity, and that if I was going to go out into the musical world on a national level, I was very interested in being connected to my home state. There wasn't anyone else writing in this way about these things at that time. So it was something I did very intentionally, in a sense, as creating a certain very, very specific and original identity.
And that's one of the things that really interests me in comparing you to Dylan. Because when you first started, people were comparing you to Dylan, one of the new Dylans and
sure.
everything. In some ways, like, persona-wise, you're the opposite. He changed his name. He surrounded himself in mystery. His lyrics are very obscure. Your lyrics tell stories. You're all about a place. You reveal so much about yourself and the world around you in your songs. You know what I mean? Like, I know that you're more than what you literally tell us about in the songs, but still, you have an identity and try to tell us something of who you are in your songs.
You just go where your psychology leads you. I think, you know, I've always loved the fact that Bob's been able to sustain his mystery over 50 or mm-hmm. 60 years. That's, in this day and age, that's quite a feat in itself. And, you know, the things that I loved about Bob's music, and I describe him in the book as the father of my country, which he really is, were things that just didn't fit when I went to do my job. You know, I'd come out of a somewhat different circumstance, and the clothes just didn't fit.
I want to quote you again. So you write, this is toward the beginning of your career. I wanted to be a voice that reflected experience and the world I live in. So I knew in 1972 that to do this, I would need to write very well and more individually than I had ever written before. And this was, at some point you realized too that although you had like the most popular bar band in Asbury Park, that there was a bigger world, there was a lot of talented people. And in order to like be someone in that world, to have a career, to make a difference, that you had to figure out what was unique about you, and you had to write great songs. And in fact, you achieved that. You wrote great songs, but you know, how did you go about trying to write the best songs that you could? I mean, when you knew that a lot of this was going to depend on the songwriting.
When I thought about signing a record deal or writing something that might put me in the position, because I'd already had plenty of things that had fallen through with my rock bands, I looked at myself and I just said, well, you know, I can sing, but I'm not the greatest singer in the world. I can play guitar very well, but I'm not the greatest guitar player in the world. What excites me about a lot of the artists I love? And I realized, well, they created their own personal world that I could enter into through their music and through their songwriting. There's people that can do it instrumentally, like Jimi Hendrix or Edge of U2 or Pete Townsend. I didn't have as unique a purely musical signature. I was a creature of a lot of different influences. And so I said, well, if I'm going to project an individuality, it's going to have to be in my writing. And at the time, for one of the few times in my life, I didn't have a band. I just had myself and the guitar. So I was going to have to do something with just my voice, just the guitar, and just my songs that was going to move someone enough to give me a shot. So I wrote songs that were very lyrically alive and lyrically dense, and they were unique. But it really came out of the motivation to... where I understood I was going to have to make my mark that way.
Bruce Springsteen speaking with Terry Gross in 2016. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures. Crying after anesthesia. Building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Let's get back to Terry's 2016 interview with songwriter and performer Bruce Springsteen, conducted at his home studio in New Jersey.
You started going to therapy in 1983. And at some point, you say in your 60s, you had a really bad depression. And I'm wondering if you thought about, during that period when you were very depressed, how many people in the world really wanted to be you? And
doesn't count for that much at the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, but of course, you know, people see you on stage and, yeah, I'd want to be that guy. I want to be that guy myself very often. You know, I get I have plenty of days where I go, man, I wish I could be that guy. And, you know, it's not quite... There's a big difference between what you see on stage and then my general daily, my daily existence.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm talking to myself.
Oh, okay.
Don't let that bother you. It's part of my illness. I do it all the time.
You're right about how being on stage is almost like medicine for you. You know,
sure.
Does it get you out of yourself? Does it?
Oh, of course. You're immediately pulled out of your you're the inside of your head, and it immediately changes your frame of mind. I've never been on stage where I've no, that's not true. I have been on stage on a few occasions where I felt I couldn't escape the interior of my interior thoughts. But Peter Wolf once said, "What's the strangest thing you can do on stage? Think about what you're doing." There's just nothing weirder you can do. If you're up there thinking about what you're doing, you're just not there. And it's not going to happen. You know. So trying to learn how to overcome those, which is a normal thing to do. You're in front of a lot of people. People are going to get very self-conscious. So you have to learn to sort of overcome that tendency towards self-consciousness and just blow it wide open, and you jump in and join all those people that are out there enjoying what you're doing together.
During the Depression, there was a period of a year and a half when you weren't on the road. You were home with one of your sons, I guess with your youngest.
Mm-hmm.
Did that contribute to the Depression because you couldn't be on stage and you couldn't have that kind of cathartic experience?
Yeah, I tend to be not my own best company. I can get a little lost if I don't have my work to occasionally focus me. But at the same time, you've got to be able to figure that out. The year and a half I was home, my son was in his last year of high school, and it was kind of my last opportunity to be here with him in the house, and I wanted to get that right.
As you mentioned in your book, you wanted to write songs that you wouldn't outgrow, that you could sing as an adult,
right,
that weren't just kids' songs, and, you know, done, accomplished.
Yeah.
But when you sing some of your early songs now, as you still do, like Born to Run, does the song have a different meaning to you than it did when you first started, performing it?
We just had a series of concerts where the show was very interesting because we'd start out with my earliest material, and we played about half a record off of our first record, and then half or three quarters off of the second record. So it was going back to my earliest music and re-singing my earliest songs that I wrote when I was 22. And it was funny that they just fit perfectly well. You know, there was they sort of gather the years up as time passes, and you can revisit. The wonderful thing about my job is you can revisit your 22-year-old self or your 24-year-old self any particular night you want. The songs pick up some extra resonance, I hope, but they're there, and I can revisit that period of my life when I choose. So it's quite a nice experience. And the songs themselves do broaden out as time passes and take on subtly different meanings, take on a little more meaning, I find.
What's an example of a song that's taken on a different meaning or more meaning for you?
A lot of the ones that are people's favorites, you know, Born to Run, that expands every time we go out. It just seems to, more of your life fills in the story. And when we hit it every night, it's always a huge catharsis. It's fascinating to see the audience singing it back to me. It's quite wonderful, you know, to see people that intensely singing your song.
As someone who grew up in Brooklyn and now lives in Philadelphia, I love that you've continued to live in New Jersey, not only in New Jersey, but not far from where you grew up. Why have you stayed close to the home that your father left? Your father went to the opposite coast when you were a teenager.
It's rather ironic, but I just felt very comfortable here, and I was uncomfortable with city life. I was more or less a kid that came out of a small town, and I was a beach bum and loved the ocean and loved the sun, and I liked the people that were here. I liked who I was when I was here. I wanted to continue writing about the things that I felt were important, and those things were pretty much here. I felt like a lot of my heroes from the past lost themselves in different ways once they had a certain amount of success. And I was nervous about that, and I wanted to remain grounded. And living in this part of New Jersey was something that was essential to who I was and continues to this day to be that way.
Bruce Springsteen, I can't thank you enough for inviting us into your studio and allowing us to do this interview.
Thank you so much. Very enjoyable. I appreciate it.
And I really love the book.
Thanks a lot.
Bruce Springsteen speaking to Terry Gross at his home studio in New Jersey in 2016. He had just published his memoir called Born to Run, and their conversation was one of our staff picks for favorite interviews of the past decade. On Monday's show, our guest will be Todd Phillips, who wrote and directed the new film Joker, a realistic origin story on the Batman comic book villain. The Joker, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is a troubled man with a history of serious mental health problems. Phillips also directed the Hangover films. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cool.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself alone again. Don't run back inside, darling, you know just what I'm here for. So you're scared.